Here on Stolen Lives, we discuss brutal and heartbreaking crimes against children. Themes may include child murder, torture, and sexual, domestic, and child abuse. I do try my best to remain respectful for the babies in these stories and leave out unnecessary details that honestly, none of us need to know to understand the frustration of why and how this ever happened. However, if you find any of these themes triggering, this podcast may not be for you. Listener discretion is advised. This week's episode is a listener suggestion. Now, I receive a lot of suggestions from you all. So many that I could do with 2 episodes a week for 2 years straight and still not have covered them all. It is important to me that you hear the stories you want to hear, for me to tell the stories that matter to you. And then I was asked in an AMA what was one story that I think about that I hadn't covered, and today's story immediately came to mind. This is one that didn't make the news headlines. Even those from Australia probably haven't heard of it. But it is stuck in the back of my mind for the last 15 years. So I'm going to play the selfish card and honour my own suggestion today. Second Life is an internet fantasy world. You can reinvent yourself and indulge in the kind of life you've only dreamt about. It was created in 2002 and would become so popular that both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama opened campaign offices in the parallel universe. At its peak, more than 36 million people were registered to play. For those who used Second Life, it was liberating, allowing them to shrug off the responsibilities of everyday life and escape. They inhabited a world without boundaries, where they could do what they want, travel where they want, be who they want, and have sex with who they want. For most, like with all gaming, this was a release for a period after a long day of work or school, before returning to the monotony of everyday life. But for others, their Second Life existence would be all-consuming, resulting in them neglecting everything else, even at the cost of the survival of their own children. This is Zaid and Lily's story. My big resolution for this coming season is to stay on track with my fitness goals and add more protein to my diet. And to help me with this, I have finally found a delicious way to get that protein in after my morning workout. That's this cereal I've discovered, Magic Spoon. I got the pack to try because making decisions aren't my best quality. And this comes with 4 flavours, cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. Magic Spoon is reimagining all these favourite cereal flavours from your childhood, except with 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and 4 to 5 grams of net carbs, all for only 140 calories per serve. That's high protein, but with no sugar. Plus, it's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, and soy-free. The first thing I noticed about Magic Spoon is a surprising crunch. I'm a fan of not adding milk to my cereal and just eating it straight out of the box. So crunch factor is important to me, and Magic Spoon has that. I'm quite partial to the peanut butter flavour. It has the slightest salt kick, and your girl does like some savoury with her sweet. It tastes exactly like a Reese's peanut butter, just without the chocolate. Go to magicspoon.com/stolen to grab a pack and try it today. And be sure to use my promo code STOLEN at checkout to save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, start your day off right with a delicious bowl of high-protein cereal at magicspoon.com/stolen and use STOLEN at checkout for $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this week's episode. Please note the victims in this story, Zaid and Lily. They are the only people who will be referred to by their name. The perpetrators, their parents, they are unable to be named under a court order to protect the safety and privacy of the surviving 4 children. Queensland, Australia. The family were a happy one. The couple were aged in their early 30s and were high school sweethearts. The father was a senior manager of a major city road project. The mother stayed at home and looked after the children, and she did have her hands full. By the time our story takes place in 2008, there were 6 children, aged 11, 5, 4, and 3 years old, as well as baby twins, Zaid and Lily, who were born in November 2006. From the outside, they were the perfect large family with a doting mother and a hands-on father. But everyone who knew the family would state there was a major change when the family moved into a rented home in the residential Brisbane suburb of Sunnybanks, Queensland, in late 2007. It was after this time they withdrew from extended family and friends. And in early 2008, this would be the last time toddlers Zaid and Lily would be seen by anyone outside the immediate family. According to court records, this was when there was an apparent breakdown in the couple's relationship. The previously present father lost his driver's license on a drunk driving charge. After this, he began to spend more time at the local pub, drinking and playing poker. And when he wasn't at the pub, he would drink alone in the bedroom, ignoring the children and his wife, spending an average $40 a night on alcohol. But all this drinking and gambling made the mother anxious, because it reminded her of the abuse she suffered as a child in a dysfunctional foster family. The mother had been in foster care from the time she was only a year old. She would allegedly be sexually abused by several foster fathers throughout her childhood. But because of this strain the father's drinking put on their relationship, the couple stopped sleeping together. Reading between the lines too in my research, I suspect the father may have been having an affair or affairs. In one contemporary news article I read, it mentioned there would be nights where the father wouldn't come home, and the mother would have to go out searching for him. But on at least one occasion, the mother found him at a female's home. Now, the father would claim he was there to play poker, but he was the only other person there. It is very possible that everyone else already left and he was just being a good friend and he stayed to help clean up. But, look, I don't know. I really don't buy that. Generally, where there is smoke, there's fire. And if it was my partner, well, he wouldn't be anymore for a whole host of reasons. To deal with her spiralling mental health and in all intents and purposes being a single mother to 6 young children, the mother started to game. In particular, she became immersed into the world of Second Life. Here, the mother could create a new identity, a new home that was always clean and orderly, even a new partner who was attentive and loved her. In real life, the mother was overweight and had 6 kids to look after. But in her new life, her avatar was beautiful, slim, and most importantly, she was child-free. It would be soon Second Life would take over her entire world. Everyone else didn't matter. The mother stopped showering regularly. She barely slept. She wore only her pajamas and didn't brush her teeth. Her mood would oscillate between anger, anxiety, and being upset. Most damaging, she didn't feed the children. Relying on the older children to feed themselves or visit neighbours or friends asking for food. Only taking enough time away from her other life to prepare several bottles filled with baby formula for toddlers Zaid and Lily. Changing their diapers morning and night. At 17 months old, Zaid and Lily should have been eating healthy balanced meals of solid food. Cut up in small pieces and drinking water and milk. From the age of 6 months old, baby formula alone does not have significant nutrients and calories to keep a child healthy and growing. And according to Mr. Google, because I forget from when my babies were babies, but children Zaid and Lily's ages would need to be changed 6 to 8 times a day, more than the twice a day the twins' mother were changing their diaper. The last sighting of the twins was in February or March of 2008, around 3 to 4 months before they were discovered deceased. Their maternal grandmother expressed concerns about Zaid's weight. The mother's reply was one of extreme honesty, that she wasn't coping and she wanted to give Zaid and Lily up for adoption. But instead of offering to help this obviously struggling mother or taking her to a doctor to get some medication or maybe even referral to counselling, instead of actually doing something, anything. No. The grandmother simply tried to reassure her daughter by telling her she was a wonderful mother and was doing a good job. From March 2008, the twins were not seen by anyone outside the mother. Even the other children in the household would later report to police they rarely saw Zaid and Lily. They were kept shut in their bedroom at all times. The eldest child, an 11-year-old girl, told her mother she was worried about the toddlers because they were very thin. Hauntingly and very foretelling, she tried to warn her mother that if she did not feed them enough, they would die. After this point, whenever the grandmother asked about Zaid and Lily, her daughter would simply say they were sleeping, her daughter becoming increasingly vague when questioned about the health of the children. Landlord Karen Lee Bennett inspected the home several times during the 8 months the family lived there. She would later report to police that she never saw any toys, bottles or diapers. The bedroom door where the twins slept was always kept shut. A week or two before their deaths, Karen attended to the home for an inspection. She remembered hearing the babies crying and sounding exhausted. This crying let her turn to sobbing. Karen reported she was concerned and asked the mother if she could go in under the guise of carrying out an inspection of the bedroom. However, the mother said no, and Karen obviously wasn't concerned enough to push the matter any further. In her inspection report, Karen would note the house was in a state of squalor. Plates stacked up in the kitchen with old food stuck to them. Clothes and other washing piled close to the ceiling in the laundry. The main bedroom was a mess of beer bottles and electrical cables. The mother had been dressed in old clothes and looked like a, quote, street person, unquote. That the mother appeared flustered and explained the mess by saying the family was having, quote, a bad run with the flu, unquote. The mother had tried to cancel the inspection, but it had been already rescheduled twice. Once when the mother had cancelled it, and another time when no one answered the door. So there was some pressure there from Karen to inspect the property this time. But despite the concerning condition of the home and the mental state of the mother, Karen never reported anything to the authorities or to the Department of Children's Services, or docs as we'll refer to them from here on through. But it wasn't just Karen and the baby's grandmother that let the family down. I imagine the older children would have been going to school in dirty clothes. The younger ones wouldn't have been bathed correctly. They may not have had any school lunches or snacks, and I would assume they would have been underweight and malnourished as well. Although I could be wrong, but the school would have had to have known something was going on and they never reported anything. And at least one neighbour knew there were problems going on in that house, because after Zaid and Lily would be found dead, a neighbour to the family would speak with the Daily Mail and said one of the older children once arrived naked on their doorstep, asking for food and to be taken in. Now I'm sorry, but if a neighbour's child turns up with no clothing and begging for food at my doorstep, I am letting them inside, giving them something to wear and a meal and calling both docs and the police, because this isn't normal. There is neglect of some level going on. But the neighbours did nothing in this instance. There was no reports to docs, no phone calls to the police. Neighbours would later state they weren't even aware the family had young toddlers. June 9th, 2008. The mother could not keep the secret she'd been harbouring any longer of what she had found a week earlier. She gathered the courage to tell her husband that their twin babies, 17-month-old Zaid and Lily, were dead, that they had starved to death. And together they agreed not to tell anyone about the deaths. That was until someone else found out their horrific secret. June 16, 2008. The eldest sibling, an 11-year-old girl, smelt something unusual coming from the twins' bedroom. She knew she wasn't to go into the bedroom, but she was worried. She pushed all that fear aside and went in to check on her baby brother and sister, only to find them lying side by side in their cot, bones visible through their skin. It was clear they had been dead for some time. What this young girl had been smelling was Zaid and Lily's emaciated bodies decomposing. not knowing what else to do, she walked up to her mother and said, quote, "I know why you have been crying now," unquote. It was at this point the mother realised the secret couldn't remain a secret any longer. She called her mother to take the surviving four grandchildren, under the guise that she needed a break. But in reality, she was going to turn herself into police. She wanted this nightmare to end. First responders would later report never having seen anything like the conditions these twins were in or were living in the last few months of their lives. Dirty dishes piled on the kitchen bench and clothes piled high in the laundry. There was large insect activity, the majority cockroaches throughout the house. The whole house contained an odour which was the strongest in the toddler's room. 11 baby bottles were found in their room, some with residue, but their contents were never analysed to know what these bottles contained. 5 tins of baby formula were also found in the house. Queensland Health Dr. Rebecca Williams was the medical examiner on the case. According to the autopsy, the level of decomposition was consistent with the pair having been dead for 7 to 8 days and both having died roughly around the same time. At 17 months old, the twins should have weighed between 9 to 14 kilograms, or around 20 to 31 pounds. But at the time of their death, Zayden and Lily weighed around 4.5 kilograms, or 10 pounds each. This is what you would expect the twins to have weighed at 3 months old, not 17 months old. Both babies lacked fatty tissue, indicating they had used all the fat surrounding their vital organs. Their limbs were very thin and their skeletal development was at the very low end of normal. For this to have happened, the twins would have had to have been underfed for a minimum of 50 to 60 days before they died. Dr. Williams' determining cause of death was malnutrition from underfeeding rather than starvation, suggesting Zayden and Lily had been fed but just not enough. The couple's 4 remaining children were placed into foster care. Initially, the couple were charged with child neglect, but after the medical examiner completed her report, these charges were upgraded to charges of murder and torture, charges that carried potential life sentences. Both pleaded not guilty and were held without bail whilst awaiting their criminal trial. July 24, 2013. The trial for the twins' murder commenced at the Queensland Supreme Court. 103 witnesses would be present in front of the judge, including the parents' own children, relatives, friends, neighbours and psychiatrists. A forensic psychiatrist testified for the defence, stating the mother had suffered from a major depressive episode that, quote, substantially impaired, unquote, her capacity to have control over her actions, pointingly referring to the mother's official interview with the investigators shortly after the twins were discovered, stating that she wanted to help the children but she just couldn't. Quote, "Every day I told myself I was going to ring the police so that my babies could be buried. I was never going to hide them, but I didn't want to give them up. I hoped they would wake up and I hoped it was a dream. It never was." Unquote. When questioned by the same investigators how the twins had passed away, she said, quote, "I don't think I fed them enough," unquote. The mother took the stand and gave evidence of the disintegration of her family in the months before the twins died, and spoke of her struggles being a mother, quote, "I loved them. It's hard to believe that, but honestly, I loved them. I thought I was doing the best that I could," unquote. For the father, when he took the stand in his defence, he simply said he was a, quote, "piss poor father," unquote. Perhaps the Weekend Australian newspaper described it better, quote, "He was there, but he was not there. Present, but not present. He was a ghost," unquote. The father admitting he walked past the twins' bedroom door at least 6 times a day, but never going in to check on them. The father's lawyer, Michael Cridlin, told the court that his client had not been responsible for caring for the twins and had not seen them since Christmas, a whole 5 months before their death, that there was not enough evidence to support any charge for his client because he did not have any responsibility for the children's care. And here is the argument. Where does that duty of care end? He was still the baby's father, even if the mother and father were estranged and she had primary care of them. He still has that responsibility to make sure the children were taken care of and were okay. August 2013. In the middle of the trial, the prosecution accepted a plea agreement, whereas the mother and father pleaded guilty to manslaughter. The mother was sentenced to 8 years in prison, 5 of which she had already served awaiting trial. She was immediately eligible for parole, a decision the judge made on the basis of her poor mental health. The father was also sentenced to 8 years in prison. He was eligible for parole in 2017. Since his release, he has done one interview, still blaming his ex-wife for the death of Zayden Lily. Quote, "I thought she was just chasing attention, always whinging and crying," unquote. And that he still holds a lot of resentment towards her for what happened, blaming her for being lazy as a reason behind underfeeding the twins. The father has since remarried to a woman who has 2 children of her own. Speaking outside Queensland Supreme Court, the twins' grandmother told the awaiting media, quote, "We all feel guilty. Anyone and everyone who went to the house or lived around there, we all feel guilty. And yes, we should have done more," unquote. Now, I have decided not to give my own opinion because this is a sensitive subject that is bound to bring up some polarising opinions. And my own may not be the popular opinion, so I will keep my feelings here to myself. But this story does bring up the debate on mental illness, postpartum depression, and the lack of support for those suffering from it. And as someone who has had postpartum depression, you feel alone and like you're drowning and things are never going to get better. You love your baby more than anything, but all the efforts to care for your baby feel impossible at times. Now, I was lucky. I had an amazing obstetrician who picked up on the signs at my 6-week postpartum checkup. But I recognise not everyone is as lucky to have these resources. So how I am going to end this story? Please check in with new parents. Offer help. Or don't offer help, just give it. Turn up with a bulk meal. Turn up with your cleaning supplies. Turn up and take the older siblings. Just turn up. And keep turning up. Be that support. They may turn and reject your offers because of embarrassment. Women can do everything, they say, but we can't. It truly takes a village. And we need to work together as a community, as a family network, to protect those most vulnerable. If you have your own thoughts and theories on the case we discussed today, or any case we talk about on Stolen Lives, please search Stolen Lives on Facebook, like the page so you don't miss an episode, and join the discussion group to talk about your thoughts and theories. You can also talk to us on Twitter, search lives_stolen, or on Instagram, Stolen Lives Podcast. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you share this episode on your social media of choice, and subscribe and leave a positive review on your podcast app. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Ali. Hosting and production was also by me, Ali. Music is by Mayu.